Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm very pleased to have as my guest today the distinguished Congresswoman from Iowa's 1st District, Marionette Miller Meeks. Congresswoman Meeks is seeking re-election to a third term this fall. Of course, listeners here are familiar with her. She's also served in the Iowa Senate and has been a public servant in eastern Iowa. Congresswoman, thank you so much for taking the time today.
It's wonderful to join you, Robin.
Well, I've seen your TV ads, and I thought the one of you in the grocery checkout line was fairly effective. Inflation continues to be a concern, and while the statistics seem to show inflation coming down, people I talk to are still very concerned about it. What are you hearing? And number two, what do you think we need to be doing to get inflation more under control than what it is?
Well, thank you so much. And I would not disagree with anything you said, and that is, while the official number may be coming down, we have to also recognize the official number. It's year over year inflation that's been at record highs. So as we know, inflation was under 2%. It was around 1.6% in December of 2020. By May of 2021, inflation was already at 5.6%. It went all the way up to 9%, the official number in 2022. And even though the official number, the CPI, has come down, prices have remained high, whether it's prices at the grocery store, prices at the gas pump, prescription drug prices, it doesn't matter. And what I hear is the same thing you said, and that is people are really struggling. They're having a hard time. They're having a hard time, you know, putting food on the table, filling. If you go buy a gas pump, you will see lots of pumps stopped at $20. And that's because people can't afford to fill their gas tank. And so people are really struggling in this environment, and also prescription drug prices are the highest they have ever been. And so we're working on all of those things. We know that this is related to government spending. We were already coming out and almost out of the pandemic in 2021. And so this is a tremendous challenge. The amount of government spending, lots of money chasing too few dollars, that fueled inflation. And there's three ways to combat inflation. One is to stop spending. The Democrats were not going to do that in the majority. And they went on to do three large reconciliation bills. The COVID relief money in March of 2021 was the first of them at $1.9 trillion. The other is to raise taxes. It wasn't very palatable. The Biden-Harris administration tried to do that, and that even their own party voted that down. And make no mistake about it, inflation is a tax on everyone. It's a tax on senior citizens. It is absolutely a tax on those making under $400,000 a year. And it affects the most vulnerable senior citizens on fixed income and, lower class, middle class working families. So it's absolutely a tax increase. And then the third way to tackle inflation is to raise interest rates. So ultimately, that's what happened. But the Federal Reserve thought this was going to be transitory, even though we were encouraging them. I interviewed with Jerome Powell and said, to me, 2 weeks is transitory, not 5 months. So they waited until 2022 to raise interest rates. That caused now interest rates on housing and cars to be sky high. What do we do about it? One, we have to prioritize government spending. We have to meet our obligations. But then where there's waste, fraud, abuse, programs that are ineffective, we can no longer say they're ineffective because they don't have enough money and we'll just give them more money. We have the VA is asking for more money, but they also gave out $50,000 bonuses. That's the kind of thing that, if you're in a business, you're taking care of your family, you don't give out, extra bonuses on the allowance when you don't have the money to do so. Prioritize government spending. Two, overregulation that's hurting our economy and preventing us from growing our economy. Right now, we're hamstringing the economy. Businesses want to grow. They're uncertain what the environment is. And so if we look at the regulatory apparatus, that is going to help us in order to grow our economy, which is the best way to increase revenue to the federal government. And then third, our tax structure. The Tax Cut and Jobs Act is due to expire in 2025. This tax cut, that was mostly went to low-income, middle-income people. It also benefited our farmers and our small businesses with both the estate tax, the step-up basis, 1031 exchanges. There's a lot of small business benefit in there, and then immediate depreciation for our larger businesses and small businesses. We passed a tax bill in the House. The Senate has done nothing with it. We have to make sure those tax cuts don't expire, because that's going to hit working families, working poor, and low-income people the most. So those are three things right now that we can do. Fourth thing, I've got a bill, the Drug Act, would help immediately to lower prescription drug prices. We have got to get that passed. It's a great bill, and it saves $656 million to the federal government. That's a bill that all of us could agree on.
I saw recently where former President Trump talked about putting Elon Musk in charge of efforts to reduce, look for ways where areas where government wastes money and regulations. And I'm old enough to remember President Reagan had the Grace Commission. Clinton had the National Performance Review. We've had efforts, but it seems like a long time since we've had anything like this. What do you think about that idea?
Absolutely. It's been a long time since we've had any look at the regulatory apparatus, the administrative burden. You know, are laws effective? Are they ineffective? Should they be sunsetted? And then how do we go after fraud and abuse? So I have a bill that would make Medicare use artificial intelligence to detect fraud. Private insurance companies do this. We should absolutely be doing this. In Medicare, there was fraud in the COVID money that went out and the unemployment benefits that went out. This is money that should be brought back in to the Treasury. And by far and away, you know, tax increases hurt everyone, but they especially hurt the working poor and middle class. We always pay that burden.
I was going to ask, too, about, and this is related to the economy, the Farm Bill. It was up, supposed to be renewed in 2023. It was extended a year. And I believe the deadline, if I'm not wrong, is September 30th. Where does that stand right now? And what do you think we need to do to get it off center?
Yeah, so I've been criticized for being honest about this. I didn't think being honest was a negative attribute, but apparently it is. We have worked very hard to get the farm bill across. So it expired in 2024. It had a one-year extension. G.T. Thompson, who's the chair from Pennsylvania, dairy farmer from Pennsylvania, had been meeting with farm groups, with farmers, traveling to every state, because there's different things that are important to different types of ag throughout our country, in order to make the best farm bill we could have. At the beginning of the year and throughout the first 6 months of the year, then it was the negotiating with the Democrats and the Senate Democrats, because they want more money on the nutrition side, whereas only about 16% of the farm bill actually goes to agriculture. It is very important. We have been working very hard. We keep pushing for it. We tried to attach it to spending bills earlier in the year. We tried to attach it to this continuing resolution that we're going to have to pass to fund the government. We're continuing to push. We haven't given up, but I think it's always a heavy lift to reauthorize the farm bill. This year's not going to be any different. But we're going to keep pushing to the last second. And then if necessary, then it will have an extension again. But farmers really need this. Corn is under $4 a bushel. Soy is under $10 a bushel. This is very problematic. We need the trade, the CRP. We need animal disease surveillance, vaccine for animals, as we're seeing another avian influenza, metapneumovirus. So these are very important things for our ag economy that we want to see get done. So we're not going to give up yet.
In most polls, it was interesting. I had a student that I teach at Monmouth College this morning say, do people up here in this area really care about the border? Why do they care about the border? And I say, absolutely, because all the polls show it's the number one or number two issue. I know you're hearing about it a lot. The data says the number of folks coming in illegally is down this year, but we still have a lot from previous years. What do we got? What do we need to do about this? I guess what would your what position would you advocate the most to kind of get this under control?
Yeah, well, first, let me just reflect that the numbers are down similar to how the crime numbers are down. If people aren't reporting crimes, or the FBI doesn't register crimes, or people are let go with no cash bail, then the crime stats will look better than they actually are. And what people are experiencing is not a reduction in crime. We're not experiencing a reduction in the number of illegal aliens, the fact that cartels are in charge of stuff, the fact that gangs are here, and the fact that record number of fentanyl is coming across, plus people on the terror watch list. So what the Biden administration is doing is, you know, after saying for 3.5 years that they couldn't do anything about it, they instituted some executive orders. But what they're doing is actually flying people through the ports of entry to have them register at a port of entry within, you know, within the middle of the country. So within the interior, these individuals are given a date to appear for their asylum hearing. If you've been to the border, which I have been 4 times, you know, the Border Patrol will tell you that 90% of people do not come back for their asylum hearing. Of the 10% of people who do, only 10% of those, so about 1% of all the people let in this country, actually meet the definition of asylum. So we need to complete the fence. We need to put all of the technology into the fence. So there's surveillance, there's camera surveillance, there's sensor surveillance. All of that needs to be in. We need to increase the number of border protection agents. We all want to have a fence with a wide gate. We support legal immigration. We have millions of people trying to come in this country legally. I have a bill to prevent the State Department from wasting green cards. The past couple of years, they have not even gone to the million legal immigrants that they can have because they're not processing the green cards because they're too busy processing people from the southern border. I also have a bill, the Afghan Adjustment Act, to let Afghan interpreters who helped our soldiers to get their visas. The State Department didn't get them the special immigration visas. It's a true stain, in addition to the whole disaster with withdrawal from Afghanistan and leaving equipment. So there are definitely things that we can do. Reinstitute the Remain in Mexico policy that you apply for asylum either in your home country or the country you're next to. You don't come into our country and then apply for asylum. And then we have to enforce our immigration laws. Do you know over 156 Democrats voted last week not to deport criminals that are that commit rape or pedophilia? 156 Democrats, I think it was 156, voted not to deport them. That's unconscionable. But we know that crime among immigrants has gone up. I even spoke on this on the floor of Congress around 11 a.m. Central Time.
Mentioned deportations. There has been talk about those who advocate strict borders and cracking down on illegal immigration. The term mass deportations has been used. Do you support deportations? And we know people are here that are undocumented, illegal, whatever you want to call it. You do support deportations of anybody who's here illegally? Is that your position?
Well, I think what a great start would be, let's deport the people that are criminals. I mean, far too often, you know, the local law enforcement doesn't contact ICE because of what their local or state government is doing. And so, or these individuals are let go and then they commit a crime. How many people, you know, how many women have to be raped? How many children have to be raped? How many people have to be killed or killed in a DUI because we've let a criminal, illegal alien go free and did not deport them? So first and foremost, let's start with that. Let's start deporting the criminals. Let's start deporting those individuals that have committed a crime and are in the criminal system. They should be going back immediately. There are ICE detention facilities that are going unused. And what about all of the unaccompanied children that we have lost? I mean, people talked about kids in cages under the Trump administration, but we have lost over 87,000 unaccompanied minors. And that means sexual exploitation and child labor and people paying off to get them across here, which only emboldens the cartels even more.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And my guest today is Iowa Congresswoman Marionette Miller Meeks. I enjoy talking to her because she's, like me, a policy wonk, and she's very passionate about a lot of things. We've discussed the border. We've discussed the economy and inflation a little bit, the farm bill. I can't go a full interview without asking you about one of your big passions, and that's veterans issues. What's been going on with that lately? You did mention relief for Afghan veterans and those who fought in Afghan on behalf of their government. What else have you been doing in that area?
So we just had a markup last week in the health subcommittee, which I chair, on the Veterans Affairs Committee. Yes, as a 24-year military veteran married to a 30-year military veteran, he had to stay longer in the service in order to outrank me or reach my rank. We both started out enlisted and retired as lieutenant colonels, but it is a passion of mine. Very concerned about our veterans. There are veterans who don't trust the VA system, and we have excellent VA hospitals and clinics in Iowa. So let me first and foremost say that. But we need to make sure that there is community care that's available for individuals who cannot get into the VA hospital, especially when it comes to mental health care, substance use disorder, PTSD. Some of the bills we just passed were to make sure that community care was available and continual if an individual wanted to stay with a community provider. I also did a bill on prosthetics so that recreational prosthetics for hunting, fishing, running, skiing, whatever activities, that those are made available to veterans in all of our VA facilities. Our goal should be to have those who are injured in war and lost limbs, that they're returned to a whole person, returned to the dignity of being a whole person and doing the things that they could do prior to their injuries and prior to their service. So hoping those bills get through. We also have bills on work, availability, how we help veterans, how we change the GI Bill so it can be used not just for a four-year education, but also for technical education and other areas where there is a shortage of individuals needed in the workforce. For instance, police or truck driving, those would be some of the career pathways that were mentioned. And then also, I think the most important issue is what we're doing on PTSD, mental health, and suicide prevention. There are far too many suicides among our veterans. We have not lowered that number. I have bills on emerging breakthrough therapy that have been very helpful, as well as making sure that people get in and making sure that the funding that goes to the VA is going to providers, whether they're doctors, nurses, nurse practitioners, PAs. We need to have individuals there to be able to take care of our veterans.
Thank you for that. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about our relations with China. I know in our past two interviews we've talked about this, and it's a hard issue. We have competing aims here. We want to take advantage of the global trading system and trade with them, but I read this, and I know you read it, how often they cheat. I mean, and there's no other word for it. President Trump's talked about across-the-board tariffs. President Biden kept, after criticizing them, he did keep some of President Trump's tariffs on things like steel and aluminum. The concern over electric vehicles undercutting our vehicles is real. And now I saw Europe today is wanting to put tariffs on steel because they're dumping steel. What are we going to do about this? What do you think? I mean, do we need to do? I know there's concern. Across-the-board tariffs are inflationary, but what do you think we need to do to approach this to kind of get a fair trading system with China?
Yeah, I think that's the biggest issue, is that it was probably too soon to make China a preferential trading partner into the World Trade Organization. And then we internationally and the U.S. has not held China's feet to the fire when they have egregious trading practices. And they're putting up barriers. We know that the Chinese Communist Party is subsidizing and supporting Chinese companies so that they can sell into the marketplace under the price that U.S. companies charge. So We have to, you know, when there are unfair trading practices, we have to call those out, whether they're in agriculture, where they let carcasses for pork or beef sit on a ship and then go rancid and then say, well, they're rancid, we're not going to accept it. Manipulation of currency. And then it is a big global marketplace. There is a, you know, a big consumer class that is rising in China. Everybody wants to tap into that marketplace, but it does no one any good, especially not the United States, if they steal intellectual property, if they copy and mimic what it is that we make. And they're rapidly developing the, you know, workforce and educational capacity to be able to mimic and then to build on their own. Energy cost is one of those things that will allow us to compete. We have to make very sure that, you know, the Biden-Harris energy policies don't lead to sky-high electricity prices here, which make us even less competitive internationally when it comes to a global marketplace. But we do need more trade agreements, and especially in Southeast Asia. This is a market where we can do that without having these trade agreements. That's allowing China to develop incursions into those areas. Africa is the same way, and we know that China has made a lot of inroads into South America, which is very problematic for us to have increasing communism in our southern hemisphere.
Congresswoman, I watched the president's debate. I'm sure you did too. And there were a lot of important topics brought up, but one was missing, and that's our national debt. I see economists from both the right and the left talking in dire terms about the growing debt we have. What do we need to do? What are some things we've touched on inflation a little bit earlier, but along with that on debt, what do we need to do to address this?
Well, you know, we're talking about national security threats when we're talking about vis-a-vis the Chinese Communist Party in China, but our debt is also a national security threat, to your point. And so one thing we talked about earlier, and that's the regulatory environment. So overregulation, regulations that, you know, stifle growth does impede us from increasing the revenue. If we grow the economy, growing the economy and increasing wages, increasing job mobility, increasing the number of people in the workforce is far more significant in reducing debt than cutting. So you have two ways to cut the debt, cut spending or grow the economy and increase revenue. Of those two, we've seen this under Kennedy, we've seen this under Reagan, we've seen this under Bush, and we saw this under Trump. Democrat presidents, Republican presidents, when we reduce taxes, control the regulatory environment, that grows the economy and it increases the revenue into our treasury, which helps us bring our debt down. So first and foremost, grow the economy, lift all boats, let everybody make more money, let everybody improve their personal situation and more jobs for more people. That's number one. Number two, we have to be mindful of how we spend what we spend on. Medicare and Social Security, these are not entitlement programs. These are programs people paid into. They have earned them. And so in order for them to be able to continue both for current people going going into retirement and for our younger generation, we have to make sure that they're solvent. So making sure we grow the economy, bring that revenue in, and then have a bipartisan debt commission to long-term look at what we do with Medicare and Social Security, I think is going to be important. The regulatory framework we mentioned earlier. And then to your point, one of the things that often gets overlooked, and that is when they allowed inflation to go up to 9%, that also relates to how much we pay the debt service on our national debt. So on our deficit and on our debt, we're paying instead of under 3%, we're now paying, you know, 4%, 5%, 6%. So it is very important that we get inflation under control, which will then also help to reduce the amount of our debt service obligations.
Switching gears a little bit, the issue of abortion is again going to be in the national spotlight. President Trump has talked about Roe v. Wade being overturned, so now states can make their own decisions. Iowa has, I know. What's your position on that? Is that just keep with that, or some are advocating more federal measures to restrict abortion further?
Well, you know, this is a decision that has been returned back to the states when with the Dobbs decision. And so states now are making decisions that's closest to the people that they represent. You know, I'm pro-life with exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother. I have always been that way. And, you know, the Democrats want to lie about my record because they have voted for to have abortion up until the time of birth. And as we know, the vice presidential candidate for Vice President Harris, Tim Walz from Minnesota, has put forth, signed laws that say if a child survives, if a baby survives an abortion, you cannot resuscitate them. You know, I don't know what's more extreme than that. So the Democrats are extreme on abortion, you know, abortion up until the time of birth. They voted on it in the House. They have voted on it in states. And this is a real position of the Democrats. I think from my standpoint, exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother are necessary. But also the other thing that's necessary is to give women all the tools so that they can determine when they want to start a family. It's why I passed in the state Senate a bill for oral contraception over the counter. It's why I've introduced the same bill here. It's why I have support for women to get the child tax credit before they deliver, not just after they deliver if they are feeling financial strain. I've supported Ashley Hinson's bill on supporting women in colleges if they're pregnant, and also support for adoption. So make sure women have the tools they need to prevent pregnancy. It's the best way to prevent abortion, to make sure they have knowledge, information, accessibility, affordability, and then support them if they decide to have a child or to for families to adopt. I've also put forth a bill for tax credits for in vitro fertilization. I consider it both pro-life and pro-growth for the economy.
Congresswoman Miller Meeks, I want to end up here with a final question. I just want to, as you know, I've done this in the past, give you a closing argument, like in a trial, to the voters here. You got about 2 minutes. Make your case to our listeners.
Well, thank you again, Rahman, for conducting this interview. And I would say I have been one of the most accessible, hardworking members of Congress. I am constantly seeing Iowans when they come to Washington, D.C. If you watch me on my social media, I am constantly in the district, visiting with people, meeting with people. And through these interactions with people in Iowa or people from Iowa when they come to D.C., we put forth legislation to solve their problems. We have put forth community project funding, which helps with childcare, which helps with bridges, infrastructure, innovative centers like we did at the North Scott High School that will lead to job creation and new careers. We're actively and diligently every single day, all day, every day, serving the people of Iowa. For that, I think that I have showed that I am a member who listens, pays attention, and solves problems. And I would ask people to, and humbly ask them for their vote this election.
Congresswoman Marionette Miller Meeks from Iowa's 1st Congressional District has been our guest today on Heartland Politics. Congresswoman, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rahman, and I'm hoping for more rain.
Listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.